She was putting an awful lot of faith in And the second marriage, he went this way, but the fact he got married. That was an older woman.
Hours that we worked over here anyway,
and I thought that the other husband, so I said, well, let's give him a try.
We were back in marriage, she wanted us to work, and she said she didn't think that, working the hours that we worked over here in the clock would be acceptable.
I gave her a husband,
so I said, well, let's give it a try. We did, and the first Saturday that Henry had us working Saturday and Sunday, I think she got that, I just can't go on. So I asked the personnel people over there to get me well-qualified yeoman who could take dictation. And one naturally who had the credentials. So he reported into me, and did you get a list of prospects? Or did they just send you one that? I think I only had one, Mr. Ehrlichman. And by that time, he'd been screened down through the hierarchy to the place where if I didn't want him, I would have probably have had to have had some reasonable justification for declining him. But I interviewed him, and I was most impressed with his credentials. First of all, he had come from an embassy, which to me was a very important factor because I wanted someone that could operate with great discretion in the environment that I was working in. So he seemed to me to be a...
He had just come from India at that time.
I don't know whether there was an interim station or not, but and there may well have been. But I do know that he had worked in the embassy. I don't think for the ambassador, but I think he worked for someone in the embassy, and I felt that this in itself was a really quite a rare tribute to find in the average run-of-the-mill Navy stenographer type.
Was he was married at the time he came
for? Or was married. I don't know whether he had one or two children.
Then, what did you set him to work doing at the beginning?
Well, he was simply my assistant. He would do my typing. He would run messages for me.
Where was he based?
We had two offices, sir. It might be well if you're not familiar with the operation, but to just remind you that there has been this liaison for 10 years. It was set up, I think, by General Maxwell Taylor. And for a number of years, the job that Al Haig had was shared, and I have, was shared by one and the same. And when this administration came in and they resurrected the National Security Council structure, I understand that General Goodpaster felt that we would have greater flexibility and we'd be able to better serve the president if we had two separate offices. Now, the Army nominated Haig and the Navy nominated me for the two jobs, I think possibly because we had the greatest experience in strategic planning and working in the pressure pot of high level.
What had been your experience before you came?
I had been a strategic planner for a number of years, and I had been executive assistant to ThinkPAC. My career and Al's were parallel for many, many years as service planners and as joint planners.
And had you been on the staff of the Joint Chiefs before?
No, I came into the Joint Chiefs of Staff for this job.
I see.
As soon as the administration, well, I guess about a week or two before the inauguration, I was commanding a squadron of destroyers in the Gulf of Tonkin, and I was informed that I was to come back to the White House and take this job.
The Colonel Joy among them was it?
No, Colonel Joy wasn't one of them. Nor the Maddox. Nor the
Quayle. When you say the two people that came over, you and Al, and you mean in the position that Al occupied at the beginning, more or less as a military
My immediate predecessor under the Johnson administration was General Bob Ginsburg, and he had two offices, the same as I had. His was in West Basement. He had really had three offices. He hung out an awful lot with Walt Rostow in West Basement, and he had the same office that I had in EOB 302. And then he had the same office that I had in the Pentagon.
I see. And is that in the Joint Chiefs complex?
The office of the chairman, sir, is not in the Joint Chiefs of Staff itself. Now, there's a statutory technicality on the composition of the Joint Staff. There can be no more than 400, so there are a number of satellite organizations built up that give the individual members of the Joint Chiefs the manpower necessary. Now, the immediate office of the chairman is to which I was nominally assigned to. However, I was also accredited to the NSC staff and had it, and had an office here.
All right, now, to whom did you report from the time you came aboard here, that is to say, the National Security Liaison?
Well, the very first day on board, I reported to Dr. I checked in with my pay records and everything, and was brought over to the White House and checked in with Dr. Kissinger.
So he was your point of contact on this end. Who was your point of contact on the other end?
The chairman of Joint Chiefs. I always felt that I had a rather anomalous job of having two bosses, and I tried to serve each with that in mind.
Sure.
And there were certain things that I would know or learn in my capacity as a member of the chairman's staff group that I would not necessarily share here, and other things that I found that I learned here I wouldn't share on the other side.
Now, what was your relationship to the other chief?
When there was an acting chief, I served him, but never, quite frankly, as openly as I served the chairman. In other words, I felt that my primary responsibility was to the chairman, the real chairman.
That was
Admiral
Morris throughout.
No, when I first came to work, well, with General Lever. I worked for a year and a half with General Lever. Not very long for Admiral Moore. After Admiral Moore relieved the chairman, I asked to go to sea with General Lever. I worked for a year and a half with General Lever. And not very long for Admiral Moore. After Admiral Moore relieved the chairman, soon as Captain Turner goes to sea, contemporaries were all flying their flag at sea, and I should go to sea. So I asked to go to sea as soon as after the turnover talked, when I thought that Admiral Moore would want to have a whole new office staff come in. But I stayed with Admiral Moore said, no, I'd like you to stay because you've got continuity that will enable me to get to know the White House better. And at that time, it might interest you to know, historically, we were just starting up many of the little substructures. When General Wheeler, when General Wheeler was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, we didn't have WESAG, or we just started it, but there were only a few meetings. We didn't have the DPRC, we didn't have the senior review group. The structure of the JCS up until that point was sort of at a level lower than Henry, Dave Packard, and Admiral Moore. The director of the joint staff would come, or General Unger, who was the J5. People from ISA would come. I forget the incident that caused the president to elevate the WESAG. I believe, my memory's a little foggy on this, I believe it was the EC-121 incident where he wasn't getting fast enough response from this substructure who simply couldn't do anything except go back to their principals and provide information. So it was that reason too, in addition to Admiral Moore being brand new, that caused him to asked me to stay on.
How long did you stay on after you came aboard?
I stayed about 11 months or 10, something like that.
And Radford was with you how many months of your tour?
I think Radford came in September and stayed until May. So it would be September, October, November, December, about 8 months probably.
When you came aboard in that job, who instructed you as to what was expected of you from the Joint Chiefs side?
I don't really think there were any instructions. This was a rather nebulous thing.
The job was pretty much what you and
my predecessors had made it. I fortunately had Colonel Lemnitzer, who was sort of a stopgap. He was a carryover from the Johnson administration for a month or so, I forget how long, but he was in a...
He was still around, Robbie, when I came, which was at the end of that year, the end of 69. Maybe he wasn't working.
No, we had two of us for a while. He stayed on. He was in the joint staff, and then General Ginsburg became so busy with President, Johnson. He was his aide. Military, he had done a huge job for a while. And he had Haig's job, and he had my job. So they brought Colonel Lemitzer in, who is the son of Lyman L. Lemitzer. And it was just difficult to, I mean, I don't think there were any terms of reference. I don't think anyone would ever write terms of reference. And I think they relied upon my judgment and Al Haig's judgment, Henry's judgment, and General Wheeler's judgment to make sure that we operated in a manner that wouldn't cause embarrassment and would it would serve the president.
Yeah.
I was simply told when I got here that my job was to serve the president. I mean, this was implicit in what I was doing.
Bobby, can you think that really what happened was Ginsburg's job was split into two, you taking the JPS liaison part of it, NSC part of it, and Al taking the military advisor?
I don't know that it broke down that
but
anyway,
the two of you really came and took over what he was doing.
Ginsburg would spend practically all of his time with Walt Rostow and wasn't able really to interface with the chairman, and as I understand it. And so when you all met, and this is strictly hearsay that I have, when you all met in New York to decide how to structure the NSC staff, that it was decided to make these two jobs two separate officers, but to co-locate here, and this is why I stayed over here in Wayak. Now, as far as time is concerned, I would probably, and I guess you'd be as good a judge as any of us, I'd probably spend 95% of my time or more here. Because as soon as I would go to the Pentagon for something, there would be an emergency call to rush back that I had to.
And that was also true of Radford when he was here. 95% here, 5% there.
I don't think Radford spent as much time here as I did.
And who defined his duty? Did you set them out for him when he came?
Generally speaking, he just carried on in a normal clerical function for me, primarily typing and. Al would call and ask for something from me while I would send Radford over from ELB just to save myself going over to get it.
From what I've learned,
and doing the legwork that I needed done, if I. Al would call and ask for something from me while I would send Radford over from ELB just to save myself going over to get it.
From what I've learned in the process of this case, I gather that your office saw virtually all the traffic. From NSC to other departments or agencies as well.
No, I don't think that's fair, sir. I realized all too often that I wasn't seeing everything, and I was just as glad as I was. Sometimes I would wonder why I wouldn't see something, and then I realized that there were good and valid reasons for it. So I certainly didn't see everything over on the JCS side. I saw what people wanted me to see, and I saw what I had to work on. Several projects would come up, say, over here, and I would actually be a pick and shovel staff officer to help develop the papers over here. And of course, those I would know more about than anything else. But no, I would estimate that I would have seen maybe, and this is very subjective, 20%. Or so of the papers that were passed back and forth.
On a basis of volume. But,
right.
But of that volume, some more essential than others, and you were right at that office is really seeing the cream of the crop in terms of sensitive material, is it not?
Well, I think that everything that we saw was, I think every paper that was processed by the NSC was sensitive. I just used that as my yard.
Yeah, but there's relativity.
No, and I don't think that a lot of the things that we saw, I mean, there were sensitive areas that I just knew intuitively that I wouldn't see. I would hear a word now and then. For example, I think one of the most sensitive operations that we had was the Sante Ray, and I didn't know about Sante Ray until the morning of the raid when we were all called into the JCS, emergency action room, to actually hear it live on the radio. Mm-hmm.